Reading Charles Williams is a very energy-consuming thing to do, and not least because he has so many conflicting ideas. They don't conflict with his presuppositions or his own convictions, but they do conflict with a lot of our rather time-worn considerations as to certain theological truths that we have assented to for centuries, and they have become monotonous and no longer have any kind of radical meaning. And he takes us right bang into their radical meanings. And believe me, if you haven't read him, you have some work ahead of you, because it is work to go back and live into truths that are, as I say, have been rather polished off by all of us and put onto a shelf and kind of allowed to sit there. There are so many things that he brings up in one novel that take you out of your usual scope of thinking and imagining and living, and to try to categorize them is sometimes a difficult thing to do. But I did try to list the major themes that he's concerned with, and then I decided to take one of the novels that is considered one of his best. It happens to be, I think, his last one, and show you in a little, in some ways, how these themes are interwoven in the plot and character and development of that particular novel. Some of you may have read the book, it's All Hallows Eve, and if you have, I don't apologize at all for repeating, because I discovered that Charles Williams needs to be read. He doesn't need it, but I do, more than once or twice, and sometimes three times. And it isn't because he's such a stylist, or because you have so many purple passages, or you want to be sure to be able to quote him correctly in the next conversation you have with a group of intellectuals, but simply because of the fact that the things that he talks about keep getting backfiring on you, and you have to start straightening yourself out and say, now, what did he really say? Did he say this? And then you have to go back and read paragraphs over and pages over, and that's a lot of work. No, really. one of the things that he's involved in that should interest those of you, some of you maybe who were in the John group in discussing pain and suffering and evil. Williams has a remarkable conviction that evil is, and what we consider evil is something that maybe in the final, if there comes any kind of finality to us, we may find that it's the back of good, and that the back of good isn't all that bad. It's bad for us now, but in the end it will be found to serve goodness in a remarkable way. This has a lot of ramifications if you start thinking that through. And I think you have to remember, as Elise reminded me, Peter Wimsey's, the vicar reminded Peter Wimsey when he started bringing up something of that nature, and the vicar said, well, but you have to remember that we have to deal with the laws that we have right now. They're the only laws we have, and we have no... whatever we want to project in our imaginations is something else, but we only have certain things to go by in this present world. You have to remember that when you're reading somebody like Charles Williams, and remember that what you're reading is an imaginative thing. It is not a set of dogmas. It isn't a systematic theology. It isn't an analysis of the Christian faith. These are all... spin-offs is too light a word, and yet they have the incandescence of a spin-off, because of the way in which they sparkle and gleam in and out amongst these novels, but they do give you a glance or a peek or some kind of an insight into some of the truths that are not yet revealed to us, that are definitely mysteries. And he doesn't intend to probe them. He doesn't want to lay them on the table and split them up and have you, go through them. But they are simply to keep us all aware of the fact that there's more to this than meets the eye. I was really interested this morning when I read my... I'm using a Catholic prayer book as of right now, and it's called A Christian's Prayer Book. And the prayer for Thursday morning in this particular part of the year was simply, Lord, open my lips, and my mouth shall proclaim your praise. To you be glory in the church and in Christ Jesus from generation to generation evermore. Amen, alleluia. And following immediately upon that was this little poem, and I sort of, shook my head and thought, am I reading this right? Who was ever so wake as this wakening day? Not just brooklet and break, but the roof too is gay with its tiles that outstand in the blue of the sky, as alive as a land and as full of reply. Breathing thanks are conveyed. All nocturnal affliction had vanished with night, whose darkness was made, oh, pure contradiction, from legions of light. And I thought, that's a very neat way to describe Charles Williams. All nocturnal affliction had vanished with night, whose darkness was made, oh, pure contradiction, from legions of light. Because this is what Williams is very much about, and what he's concerned with is getting us to see that we have to live in the contradictions of our faith and of the existence that we're in, of the two kinds of nature that we deal with, nature and supernature, and how do we live with that and remain any kind and hold on to any kind of a consistency, if consistency is what it's about. Somebody called Charles Williams God's spy in our generation, just like they called Søren Kierkegaard. I think that's such a nice little phrase that everybody seems to have applied to anybody that happens to be his or her particular favorite at the moment. But it is, in a sense, a good thing to say about anyone who is doing a work that is definitely of an underground nature. Williams once wrote a review of a book about the Jesuits, and in that review he said he was very interested in it and was very, in fact, he was rather more inclined toward the Jesuits than he was toward Pascal, which I could understand his point of view, but I felt badly for Pascal because I really like him. But he did say that he wondered if anybody had ever made an order dedicated to the glutton and the winebibber. That kind of an order. Does anybody recall who would be the patron saint of that order? Who was referred to?
Christ.
Yes, it was to be an order under the lordship of Christ of gluttons and winebibbers. Now, we can all titter and say, well, of course, everybody knows that you're supposed to be thin and you're supposed to be ascetic, and everybody knows that Jesus was that way, and that, how they got that, peculiar way of talking about him is really odd. It's a rather phony tradition. That's the kind of things we say to ourselves, of course, because we have our own preconceived notions of what holiness should look like. But William said, You know, this is something that ought to be considered. What would happen also if there were an order of people similar to the Jesuits, but instead of concerned with the direct communication and the direct derivations of the glories of God, who were all concerned with the indirect ones and were therefore a hidden group and a group of people that you just really didn't know where you had them and you didn't know who they were. Now, of course, that doesn't fit in very well with, you know, they're going to know we're Christians by our love and that everybody's going to be patting us on the back and saying, you know, if I could be a Christian like you, I'd be one. I mean, there wouldn't be that kind of compliments handed out because nobody would know who you were. You'd be definitely a spy. You'd be an underground agent. You'd be somebody that didn't have all that obvious kind of quality that makes people recognize at once, aha, that has the hallmark of Christianity. Maybe people like that would be more of the kind of people that you know, were called Christians in the first place when it was used as a bad word rather than a good one. This doesn't, of course, mean that Williams was talking about this group of people, if there were such a group, if there were such an order, that they would all be really a nasty lot, but rather that they would be doing such work as they were doing in a different and an unexpected way, so that people would not know that they were being leavened. And they weren't being, you know, grabbed at and said, hey, you know, I got something to tell you. And they'd find out that something was being told them, but it wouldn't be in the way that they expected. And it isn't that kind of an easy order to be in, because the people in Charles Williams's novels, who are definitely people who are committed to the Lord, are always involved in some really hair-raising experiences. And I mean literally hair-raising. Oh my, it went off my nose, and I hope it didn't blot too much of my paper. Mm-hmm. For the benefit of the tape, that was just water that went off my nose. Since I was talking about gluttons and wine bibbers, I didn't want anybody to get the idea that I was, you know, adding some specific illustrations to this discussion. The one thing I have to remind you of, though, in thinking about Charles Williams as a Christian, as a theologian, in the imaginative sense, he never called himself a theologian in terms of of any kind of, you know, really nice, meaning the English understanding of the word nice, I mean an accurate meaning of that term, theologian. He was a person who thought and lived theologically continually, but he, as I say, he did not belong in the category of theologians. But I do want you to remember that his books are thrillers, as I said. They're not cozy little things to read, you know, and get a nice devotional feeling before you go to bed at night. Because if you get involved in them, they really scare you. Because one of the great themes in Williams's whole thinking in his life is that there's no division between that which is supranatural and that which is natural. In other words, you can be well invaded by the evils and the demons and the magicians of this world, as well as by the angels and the heavenly bodies and the people of the heavenly kingdoms. In other words, that we are not living in a double standard. And he completely wiped out any kind of easy rational position in which, well, of course, you can explain it this way because this is where we live. But you must remember that they were not in that kind of knowledge at this particular time. He just discounts all that and says, you've got to remember that you're dealing with something here that is not in scientific categories. It doesn't go in in that kind of knowledge. You are living in one world. Just as the incarnation is body and soul, man is body and soul. He's not a dichotomy. He's not a body that's inhabited by a soul. The Word is not inhabited by Christ. The Word is Christ, and Christ is the incarnate God moving amongst us. And this is very, very clear in Williams's thought. And this is important in his novels. And this is why I say, when you read his novels, you find out that your life, if you happen to decide you thought it'd be fun to belong to that particular order of undergrounders, would be a very unpredictable one, because you don't know what you might get into. Now, of course, it's also true, as those of you who have read The Great Divorce, how many of you read The Great Divorce? Now, I'm not going to ask you if you remember this line, because I'm sure that's not fair. But you do recall, I imagine, that Lewis uses George MacDonald as the guide to the man in The Great Divorce, just as Virgil is Dante's guide in the Divine Comedy. And George MacDonald, as the guide, says to the man in The Great Divorce, but remember, when you are talking about this to other people, remember to explain to them that this is a part of an imaginative thing. This is not, you know, these are not, these are, this event or these stories or whatever that we're talking about, these are not historical facts that we're dealing with. These are truths that we have to get through to each other by means of symbols. We do have to remember that symbols are not lies, but they are another kind of truth that we have to deal with if we're going to be, if we're going to get this kind of meaning to people who are completely outside of this understanding of life. In other words, if you're going to try to unite the natural and the supernatural, if you're going to insist that people live in one world, you're going to have to give them a whole new vocabulary, a whole new way of thinking imaginatively, so that they can get this through into their lives and into their thinking. And he said, this is important that you don't quote this as if it were line by line, verse by verse, in some scripture, and that you know, you're going to prove it like a scientific statement or some kind of a proof in a lab. And this is, I think, I didn't know whether it was necessary to bring that up or not, but sometimes people forget that when they're reading books of this nature, and when they do that, they really get themselves entangled, because they say, yes, but how does that fit into this? Well, that's for you to try to live with and figure out and try to live out from, in terms of what actually is a symbolic representation. MacDonald ends this little statement with a very neat little thing when he says, if ye come to tell what ye have seen, make it plain that it was but a dream. See, make it very plain. Give no poor fool pretext to think ye are claiming knowledge of what no mortal knows. And this is very, very clear when you read any of these imaginative things that are written, whether it's Tolkien or Lewis or Charles Williams or whoever. You do have to remember that these are not things that are supposed to be, proved as if it were some kind of a geometrical theorem or something like that. But that does not deny the fact that what he's talking about and what Williams is proposing, that the convictions and the statements that he's illustrating, that they are not true. They are definitely truths that he holds to, and that's why he's been so busy about writing these novels, which he felt were secondary in importance. The only thing that he really thought was important that he'd done in terms of writing was his poetry. I think that the book that I'm discussing, that I'm going to discuss today, is one that really I think you could all read with real benefit. How many of you have read All Hallows Eve? Anybody else? And Peter has. I don't think we have that in the bookstore. Has it come in yet? Yeah. We've been trying to get it, and why that one of all of them should be left out, I don't know. Everything else is in paperback. I don't know why Erdman's has not, you know, gotten going on the publishing, unless do they have something against baptism? Because it's very important in this book. It's the only thing I can think of that would be, that would be a dismaying thought to a publisher. But they are very concerned about publishing all of the works of the Inklings as much as they possibly can. But the book is especially good to read in the month of October. It's a good book to read in connection with the fact that we have that it's the month of the Reformation, but it's also the month of previous to All Saints' Day, and the book has its climax on All Hallows' Eve, or the Eve of All Saints, and it has specifically to do with that particular evening because of the effect of the cloud of witnesses upon the kind of demonic and devilish work that is being enacted during this the plot of this book. The great themes that you're going to be aware of in Williams, not only in this book but in the other books that he has written, are, I would say, first the fact that the world is one, the unity of the world, that you can't split it up, any more than you can honestly divide your thinking and have a double standard of thought. You have to realize that if you're going to take Christianity, you are not going to be able to prove it piece by piece. If you're going to do that, then forget about talking about belief. I mean, don't call it belief. Just say, this is another thing that I've proved. The Williams was adamant on that subject, and very often you run into in various places in the novels the fact that they decided to believe in something. Now, I want you to remember that these are underground books. These are not books that are necessarily propagating Christianity, that is, in an obvious way. He doesn't, you know, these are not Sunday school novels. This isn't Grace Livingston Hill quoting scripture on the first page and then showing you how everything is going to work along to prove that this is the way it's going to be. It's the books are very much a curved kind of a witness in and out, and you can't put your finger on where this and that is going to come out in the story. You may find that what one person you think is going to turn out to be very helpful in the book turns out to be not that way at all, at least from your point of view, until the very end. And so you can't really put your finger on where it's going to be good salesmanship as far as Christianity is concerned. They're not written that way. So don't get your heart set on that kind of an approach, because it isn't there. This unity of the world, the importance of the unity of man, the fact that there's not a dichotomy between spirit and flesh in the usual term, not Paul's use of it of Sark's and the way he uses it, where he's thinking about that which wars against the spirit, meaning warring against God, but in terms of the body as being something that's evil. It's definitely not, as far as Williams is concerned, it's part and parcel with the soul. And then a second thing that he's very strong on is the identity and the power of the city of God. And the city occurs over and over again throughout these novels in various ways. The city, in a real way, is the communion of saints. It's Christ. It's the power of the people who love the Lord working together in and out and amongst each other. And he has a great deal to say in many of his essays and his reviews on the city as such. In this particular book, the city is extremely important, and there's a marvelous description of London as the heroine of the book stands and looks at London and sees in London all the other cities of the world sort of flowing in and out of her as she sort of has a vision of all of the world under the lordship of Christ. Jesus Christ, by the way, is not mentioned in this book. Never. So I hope you know his name well enough to recognize his footprints when you see them. The third point that is extremely important in Williams is what he calls the way of exchange. Now, this is very Lutheran, and he doesn't care much for Luther or Calvin, but that's all right. I don't think Luther cares whether he gets the credit or not. The way of exchange was almost the determining and identifying thing about everything that Williams talks about, because it's the way in which the city is able to exist. It's the way in which you and I exist in God. It's the way that God became a part of us. And another word for it is co-inherence. Now, that's a really tough term to catch because, you know, we know what inherent, when something is inherent, we know what that means. But if you start talking about co-inherence and refer to it as something that has to do with Christianity, then you've got to work it all out, and it sounds kind of clumsy. But it isn't all that clumsy, because co-inherence is just another way of saying that everything that we do, as a part of what God has done for us. That God, when he became man, that was a co-inherence, because he took man up into God, into the Godhead, and he co-inhered them. He made them a part of each other. As a result of this kind of exchange that happened in the incarnation and the crucifixion, which are all bound up together, you and I, if this really has grabbed us, are going to be living in a substitutionary way for other people. Now, this is where it gets tough. It's very easy to say, you know, he ain't heavy, he's my brother, which, by the way, was the slogan long before you were born. I'm using the old one, not the one that you knew. I don't know if, Bill, do you remember that when they used it for... No, before that. It was used... was used for a united appeal years and years and years ago. It was way back in the 40s. Something like that. It was he ain't heavy, he's my brother. And now I guess we've got a song about it. It's been used a lot since, but there was a big gap in between before it was reused. But it's always been, comes to the surface every time anybody talks about substitutionary living or anything, because it's a perfectly natural way to refer to it. This, however, is a lot more difficult kind of substitutionary living than giving money or even just, doing a little counseling. You know, oh, well, I'll sit down and listen, sure, you know. Got something to tell me? I'll help you. You know what else is involved in this substitutionary kind of life? You and I have to accept help from other people. And that's a really nasty thing to have to do, because when you feel that you're a Christian and you have got something to give and you've got a shoulder that's good and strong, now go ahead and cry on it. You know, I'm strong. The Lord's taken my burdens, buddy. I can handle you. You know, I don't have to worry. But what if somebody says, you know, I'd like to help you. And you say, help me? I don't need any help. You know, I've been helped. I'm ready to go and I'll help you, but don't ask me to accept any help from you. But that, unless you can do it both ways, it doesn't work. And you know, that's a tough thing, you know, to be the one that ain't heavy. Some of you, a lot of you, probably haven't tried it. One of the hardest things for me in prison camp was to have to accept the gifts of the Filipino ladies' aides. I didn't like their taste in the flannels they sent in that we had to make dresses out of. But I just kind of didn't like the idea that, you know, I should be giving to them. Why should they be giving to me? It was very salutary, I must say, for my ego. But it didn't last long. I don't think anything like that lasts long. I think you have to keep relearning things like that. It was very salutary, I must say, for my ego. But it didn't last long. I don't think anything like that lasts long. I think you have to keep relearning things like that. But that's the tough, one of the tough things about substitutionary love is, and substitutionary living, is that you've got to be willing to accept somebody else's as well as being so eager to give to someone. It's such a comfort to us to be able to give. It's real humility to be able to accept. Now these themes are very, as I say, very definite, definitely woven in to the story of All Hallows Eve. He's a good writer. He's not the kind of person that, you know, said, now watch, here it comes, here it is, and builds up a certain kind of you know, introduction to each particular theme. I mean, I know you wouldn't expect that kind of thing, but even he doesn't even do it stylistically. He just rolls it out, and that's why it's such a lot of work to read these books, because you have to go back and try to figure out where the plot went, and you are really involved in the plot, and you want to know what's happening, and he's gotten you all involved in like looking at the city and looking at Paris and Chicago and. And you think, you know, now where was she? Is she alive or is she dead? And you have to go back and find out where she was standing. She was standing on the parapet of the Westminster Bridge and looking out. And then, okay, now we'll start over again. And then you go through that's the way he is. And that's why I say it requires effort. So don't read him if you expect to get something, you know, in 10 easy lessons, because it doesn't go that well. The story is involved with two people, two girls who are dead, and the rest of the people are living. And it all takes place in the same place in London. And London is both a city of the dead and a city of the living at the same time. And the action is all an interaction between the dead girls and the living people. Now, that, you see, requires a little doing to make it believable. And yet it is believable for some strange reason. I mean, I get turned off by magic. But you know, some of this is built up into such a style and a way of telling the story that you can accept it, because when you start reading it, you accept the premises. And that's how it goes. The first chapter is called New Life, strangely enough, and it happens, the chapter is involved with this young heroine named Lester Furnival, who who is dead, and why they call it new life, well, that remains for you to discover. I'm not going to tell you the whole story. I mean, these chapters are long, and I'm not going to go into all the ramifications of everything. But anyway, she's dead. And she was killed by it's right after World War II, and she was killed by a military plane that crashed right behind her, and she comes to and is standing on the bridge in London, and she's trying to figure out what's been going on, and I'm going to read you this little description of what it's like to be dead. Because I'm sure you don't know. I didn't. Dead. And she was thinking about the fact that she had that the last time she saw her husband, she'd been quarreling with him, and she had to she had to make up with him, and she hadn't, and really well they'd made up and sort of, but you know, the last memory they had of each other was kind of, she just had this feeling that they had a fight. Dead. And she'd done it once too often. Dead. And this had been their party. Dead. Her misery swamped her penitence. They told each other it made no difference, and now it had made this. They'd reassured each other in their reconciliations, for though they'd been fools and quick-tempered, high egotists and bitter of tongue, they'd been much in love, and they'd been but fighting their way. But she felt her own inner mind had always foreboded this. Dead. Separate. Forever separate. It did not, in that separation, much matter who was dead. If it had been she, on that instant, she knew it. The word still meant to her so much only this separation that the knowledge did not at first surprise her. One of them was dead. She was. Very well. She was. But then, she was. On that apparent bridge, beneath those apparent stars, she stood up and knew it. Her tears stopped and dried. She felt the stiffness and the stains on her apparent flesh. She did not now doubt the fact and was still not surprised. She remembered what had happened, herself setting out to meet Evelyn at the tube. And the tube, by the way, of course, is not the TV. It's a subway. And instead coming across her just over there and there stopping. And then the sudden loud noise, the shrieks, the violent pain, the plane had crashed on them. She had then, or very soon after, become what she now was. And then she goes on a little bit, and then she says, it was all quite proper, quite inevitable. She had pushed him away, and there was an end to Richard, but there was no end to her. Never in her life had she contemplated so final an end, which was no end. All change had carried on some kind of memory, which was encouragement. She had not always supposed it to be so, she told herself when she left school, when she was married, that she was facing a new life. But she had, on the whole, been fortunate in her passage, and some pleasantness in her past had always offered her a promise in the future. But this, however, was quite a new life. Her good fortune had preserved her from any experience of that state which is almost inadequately called death in life. It had consequently little prepared her for this life in death. Her heart had not fallen ever through an unfathomed emptiness supported only on the fluttering wings of everyday life, and not even realizing that it was so supported. She was a quite ordinary and rather lucky girl, and she was dead. Well, now you know that she was dead. That's the way it starts, and that's what her new life is involved in. And she meets Evelyn, who first she sees her husband coming across the bridge, and she gets really excited. Well, they're going to have a chance to meet, and maybe he's dead too, and then they're going to have a chance to see each other, and everything's going to be fine. And she moves toward him, and she keeps going, and then she realizes that he comes up to her and turns around, goes the other way, and there isn't any recognition. He didn't recognize her. Obviously, he didn't see her. She wasn't there. She was dead. Well, something for you to think about when you think about death, you know. Really is, I'm not saying this is not doctrine, this is a story. Okay, she does meet her friend Evelyn, who is sort of a friend. She didn't like her very well. Evelyn is a whiner and a complainer, and she feels sorry for herself, and she fusses and stews all the way through the book. But anyway, she does meet her, and they decide they better stick together, especially because Evelyn won't let go of her because she's so scared. And And she keeps, and Evelyn keeps saying, I've never done anything wrong. Why is it happening to me? I don't know, why did it happen to me? And Lester's got a lot more sense, and she sort of thinks, well, I don't know why it happened to me either, but, you know, but she at least doesn't say it out loud. But you do get the feeling that, that you know, this is going on as a kind of a, it's sort of a running comment, and you recognize it. Very, very, very much of a comment that you've heard yourself and said yourself. And then, all of a sudden, she, when she saw Evelyn the first time, Lester says, she saw Evelyn, and Evelyn instead of Richard, and she stared down at the other girl, and she exclaimed aloud, oh my God. It was the kind of casual exclamation she and Richard had been in the habit of throwing about all over the place. It meant nothing. When they were seriously aggressive or aggrieved, they used language borrowed from bestiality or hell. She had never thought it meant anything. But in this air, every word meant something, meant itself. And this curious new exactitude of speech hung there like a strange language, as if she had sworn in Spanish or Pushtu. And the oath had echoed into an invocation. Nothing now happened. No one came. Not a quiver disturbed the night. But for a moment she felt as if someone might come, or perhaps not even that, no more than a sudden sense that she was listening, as if to hear if it was raining. She was becoming strange to herself. Her words, even her intonations, were foreign. In a foreign land, she was speaking a foreign tongue. She spoke and did not know what she said. Her mouth was uttering its own habits, but the meaning of those habits was not her own. She did not recognize what she used. I haven't done anything. Oh, my God. This was how they talked. And it was a great, precise, prehistoric language forming itself out of the noises their mouths made. She articulated the speech of Adam or Seth or Noah and only dimly recognized the intelligibility of it. She exclaimed again despairingly, Richard. And that word she did know. It was the only word common to her and the city in which she stood. And as she spoke, she almost felt that she saw him. Well, it's quite important that she uses the word, that she uses these, that they use their names, because those names are important. They identify these particular people. They were baptized in these names, and this is what is, you know, has real meaning. But at any rate, that's the way the story starts. And it goes on with a great deal of a kind of a, is somebody calling for something? Somebody playing something? Sounds, I guess I'm getting too involved in the city of the dead. I must have been listening for something of a flute. At any rate, the story goes on a very, well, if you lay the plot out very simply, it runs in these lines. These two girls are wandering around in this city as dead girls. Their Lester's husband Richard goes to visit a young man, a friend of his who's an artist, and he goes to see his paintings, and as he looks at the paintings, he says, no, I really liked that one, it looked like creation. And Jonathan says, well, it's a picture of London, you know, just a new one I just did, but it has a glow to it which makes you think of the city of God. And this is part of the sort of the whole sort of weaving train that goes through the whole story. As they stand there, he also sees a picture of a painting of what looks like a man, but it looks like a beetle, and not our beetles from Liverpool, but a real beetle. This man is standing there with as if he were some kind of a preacher, and out in front of him is a whole stream of small beetles coming towards him. And you know, it's I don't know how many of you read that story of Kafka's where the man turns into a bug. Mm-hmm. Horrible one. Well, this is sort of the way you think of it, only you feel that these people have turned into beetles in the way that Ionesco has his people turn into rhinoceroses. Rhinoceroses. You know how they, it is as rhinoceroses, is it, William? If it's plural. It can't be rhinoceri. But at any rate, you get the feeling of the way people become, they become what they're following. And this painting was not supposed to be that kind of a painting. It's supposed to be the painting of this great leader who is, as it happens, the man who is in charge of the young lady that Jonathan wants to marry. And so he painted this picture of him in order to please her and her mother, and hopefully it convince her mother, Lady Wallingford, that her daughter Betty should marry him. Alas, it doesn't work out that way, because when Lady Wallingford comes to see the painting, she says, "It's horrible. He looks like a beetle. What have you done with our father?" And you realize at once that this is, that there's been a real worship kind of a relationship between this man and these people that are his followers, and Lady Wallingford is sort of his priestess, and she feels very much the same way. It happens his name is Simon the Clerk, and he's a magician who has worked out all kinds of necromancies and ways of where he hopes to gather in the three, he and perhaps the leader of the Chinese and of Russia will come together and become the leaders of the world and sort of fix everything up so we'll have peace. And there's no kind of political undertone, no slurs at anybody, Churchill or Roosevelt or anybody. This is entirely, a story, and the complete stupidity of thinking that somebody could really make that kind of peace when the individual people are not converted and changed. But this is the easy way out that everybody wants. And in the as the story develops, you find that the Simon has not only is this daughter of Mrs. Wallingford's his daughter too, but he has had this relationship with Lady Wallingford so that he could use this girl as his particular servant, and he's going to eventually work it out so that he can disembody her and send her out into the town, into London, and read the papers for him so that he can see what the future papers are saying about him, so he can be sure that he's actually in the picture. He wants to know what the news is going to be in the next 100 years, because he already is 200 years old. It's really interesting the way this works out, because you see, this disembodied person is supposed to go out and check out all these newspapers, and that's supposed to help the magician, who obviously, with all of his other abilities, can't look into the future. He has to depend on what somebody else is going to read for him in the newspapers that are at this time already published and printed in the City of God. Now, can you see how difficult that is to read? That's a really complicated business. And all these things go along and they work out in a perfectly sensible way. You're drawn along and you begin to nudge and say, "Yes, well, I certainly hope that doesn't work out that way." And you really, have a suspension of disbelief. You do identify with this crazy story. But it's because the way in which Williams writes it is such that it has a convincing quality. And the quality is of the kind that appeals to your mind in a way that gets your imagination involved in it. Because he doesn't write cheaply. He doesn't write sloppily. He writes very well. And you're used to having people who write well, give you a fairly decent bag of tricks, and so you think, well, this must be fairly true. And so you're willing to go along. And actually, it has enough truth in it, in terms of your own recognition of how easy it is for us to go into that kind of thing, that you're willing to also to believe in it. The story, alas, goes through some very sad turns and twists. And in the process, Betty, this young girl, is going to be, she's going to be killed in a sort of a graduated way so that she can eventually move into this particular form that Simon the Clerk is going to have her become. When she's when this is about to happen, Lester, who had known Betty as a schoolgirl, and who had, well, she hadn't been mean to her, but she had rather ignored her because she didn't care much for her, and her friend, the Evelyn, had really been malicious towards her and had really been nasty, and in that relationship as schoolgirls, Evelyn, when she sees Betty walking in the streets of London, in this little mission that she had to go on for Simon, at once gets furious and says, "Oh, let's get away from her, or else let's pester her some more. I hate her." And Lester feels quite differently. She doesn't feel that way at all, and she feels concerned about Betty. And in fact, she feels so concerned that she is drawn to the house where Betty lives, and they go up there, and Evelyn tries to keep Lester from going in, but Lester says no, she feels she has to go in there. And true enough, Betty has already gone back to the house and is in the process of being worked on by Simon the magician. When she's going through this, Lester, well, there's some other things that happen that are really interesting in terms of forgiveness, but and she and Betty talk to each other, and Betty forgives her for the wrongs that she's done. And then Betty goes to sleep, and then as they're sitting there waiting for Simon to come in because Betty knows he's coming. They have a discussion on what forgiveness is, and Lester says, "You have to remember the things that I did to you," and Betty says, "Well, you were nice to me. It was Evelyn that was so nasty." "No," Lester said, I was nasty too. I was really, you know, I was nice on the outside, but really I did some mean things to you." And finally Betty says, "Well, if you feel that way, okay, I forgive you. Don't feel badly about it anymore." And she said, and Lester said, "Are you sure you remembered everything?" "Yes," Betty said, "she remembered everything." Now that sort of caught me. Sometimes when you think about saying something to somebody and asking for forgiveness, you think, well, it's going to hurt them more than it. I shouldn't tell them, it's going to make them feel miserable. But in this particular situation, it didn't. Betty was perfectly willing to let it happen to her, and she had to remember some things that were bad for her to remember. But then Lester really was forgiven in terms of Betty's own forgiveness. Now this, as I say, this isn't doctrine. This is a novel. Okay. When Betty goes to sleep, and Lester stays right next to her, and Simon the magician comes in with Betty's mother, and he starts working the spell on her. Lester, in this situation, is a perfect example of Williams's concern about substitutionary love. Lester lies right next to Betty on the bed, and Simon, of course, doesn't see her because Lester, you remember, she's dead. But you know, the way I talk about her as if she's alive, but then that's the way she talks, so I can't help it. I have to, you know, I've got to report her as she is. She's lying there next to Betty, and Simon only sees Betty. But by Lester's willingness to take over this particular situation, Simon begins to talk to Lester instead of to Betty. Betty goes to sleep, and Simon deals with Lester and begins to work his spell on her, and she feels it happening to her, and she, although she's dead, she is going through this whole thing. It's a really frightening thing for her, but the interesting thing is that as she's going through this, she feels herself leaning against something, and she finds that she's leaning against something wooden that's supporting her back, and it comes up way to here, and she finds her arms are stretched out and they're being supported, and she's lying on a cross. And in the process of this, just as she is lying there, and she thinks that the whole thing is, you know, that he's really going to take over and she's really going to be completely his servant, something happens. There's an interruption, and Simon's charm fails, And the whole thing breaks down. And he looks at the bed, and he sees what looks like two, and yet he knows it's just one. And Betty is lying there, and so is Lester, and they're both there. And yet the charm is gone, the spell is gone, and he and Lady Wallingford decide to leave and try it another time. Well, this was the needful kind of substitution that had to occur for Betty to be freed from the real control that Simon had over her. I'm not going to tell you how the story ends, because there's a lot of really kind of hair-raising and exciting things that go on in the process. But I hope that it hasn't oversimplified the plot for you, because this is the only problem with telling you a story of it, is that you lose some of the involvement that you get as you read Williams's own writing, because he does make you feel that it's a real thing. Don't you think so, Liz? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's not, and Peter, you've read this.
But in the power of the word, it doesn't, that's just an empty phrase until you read Williams, because you don't want to believe it.
Mm-mm.
You say, this is crazy, but you do believe it.
It's not, that's right. Although, as I say, there are some things about it that I really know. I think it's a little corny. I can't quite take all of it. But
the experience of a different...
But it doesn't matter, because really, you as I say, it's this sort of suspension of disbelief that allows you to enter into almost a para-world, and yet it isn't another world. It's a world in which people are living and eating, and they come back and forth, and you know, it's the same world. It's as if it were happening at Holden, and two people who were dead were walking around here and coming in and out of our lives, and we didn't see them. I mean, you know, you can't see them, but they're there. And they're involved in something that's going on. Well, you say, you know, well, what's the point? You know, it's kind of, why not read just straight science fiction and forget it, you know? Now, why bother to read anything this, you know, it's got all this in it? Well, you know, you ask yourself, how far are we willing to go in the way of exchange? How far are we willing to go in terms of, you know, substituting for somebody else? You know, the book rests on this kind of thing. And you say, oh, well, the Lord isn't going to ask me to do that. Oh, well, I don't know, you know. He doesn't ask people who aren't, you know, who aren't willing, I guess. Although it's true that he does get you ready, and this is what he did with Lester. But you know, he's never talked about him. You know, you don't see anything. The Lord isn't walking around saying, no, now, Lester, remember what you learned in Sunday school? Remember that Bible verse. You don't get any of that. It's just, you know, some of these situations begin to move in on her, and what has happened to her earlier in her life, her faith, whatever it is that has done it, the power of the sacraments is always present. These things move in and make the underplot of the story a great kind of a pilgrim's progress of Lester through the holy city to the center and the depths of the holy city of God. Now, you could call it purgatory, but it isn't that. It isn't that kind of thing. It's just an imaginative way of bringing us to realize that time, do we believe that time is historically the same? Is that historical for God? Does he have the same time we do? You know, what is place in terms of God? And you begin to think in terms of the possibility and the impossible possibilities of what the Lord actually can do with people if they were a little crazy. And I wonder if some of being fools for Christ doesn't have to involve some elements of this kind of wildness and imaginative fancy that allows you to see that the world is indeed, you know, his kingdom in which we're living. You don't have to read Charles Williams, but I would dare you to, because it is a kind of challenge to find out what one of his novels. And I might say that he is a man who has, I think, is an example of someone who really, he didn't educate himself, because he did go to the University College in London for close to 3 years on a scholarship, but he had no money. And the only thing he could do was to take a job as a proofreader in the Oxford press. And because of his motivation, he became one of the most well-read men of English letters of his particular period, and particularly in the kinds of things he was doing. And besides that, he got an MA degree, honorary MA degree from Oxford, and became a tutor, which is unheard of. I mean, they're the real sticky people on whether you get your footnotes in. And you know, this happened. So, and it isn't because he prayed to the Holy Spirit to give him a lot of extra smartness, but he actually studied and read and loved it. I mean, you know, it can happen to people, even if they don't get scholarships.
Something that's eerie about it, the scariest thing is, the scenes that you'd normally, in a regular book, would be scary, are scary. I mean, the scary situations aren't scary in the same in the way Poe would write them. The most frightening thing for me is that I believe this.
Mm-hmm.
And it's happened. Mm-hmm. And it, in a sense, there's nothing, no particular frightening incident that I've read in Williams, and yet the whole thing frightens me,
mm-hmm.
the sense of the power